This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
The following is a production of the Emerson News Network.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
Motherfuckers, get in here. I got a little announcement I want to make. I know a lot of you guys have seen me around town going, hey, there's Steve, the new guy, running the cockfighter. Well, I have a confession to make. My name's not Steve, and I'm not a cockfighter. I'm a ball player. And not just any ball player. I'm Kenny Powers. And I reveal myself to you all here upon this field. Behold! It's my rookie card. It's me on the front. Y'all want to just pass this around so you can just see it? I'm going to need to get it back, though. You know, I see the look on your faces. You're thinking, hey, Kenny, you're from America. You probably have a printer. You could have just gone on the internet and printed that bitch. Yeah, you know what? I could have. Except for one fact. I don't own a printer. And I f***ing hate computers. All kinds. I come here today not just to bash on f***ing technology, but to offer you all a proposition. Let's face it. Y'all f***ing suck. Don't get your feelings hurt, all right? Don't get sensitive on me here. I f***ing suck too right now. I'm in the darkest third world hole I've ever been in my entire life. About 1,100 million miles from where I should be. And the only way for me to get back there is for us to join forces. If we can make enough noise down here, then just maybe everyone in America will hear us. Everyone will. And they will all know that Kenny Powers is, in fact, the Christ figure that they perceive me to be. So if you all don't believe my words, then perhaps you will believe this. Anyone have a ball? Can I get an El Ballo? Right there? Woo! Okay, got it. If this was America, you'd have a radar gun, and right now, it would read 101. When's the next game, coach?
Friday.
See you dumb motherfuckers there. Where's the baseball card? It's worth $5. Take that with me. Trying to pocket it. Keep my fucking eye on you. All right, don't forget, my number's 55.
Rogers, ¿qué carajos está pasando, güey?
Woo! Woo! 55! See you motherfuckers Friday!
You say so. It is 19 minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of September in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making it part of your listening day, live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new home for whimsy. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. It is Wednesday, September 29th, 2010. We're drawing near that ye might be entertained on this fine afternoon. We are here in the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. It is 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. If you would like to join us today with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have. It's 503-505-6964. 6964, 503-505-6964. You can Skype as well. That is Rick Emerson Show. That is the username via Skype. And if you'd like, you can email us, rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Which really raises the question of how many times can I possibly say my own name, and in how many different ways can I use the phrase Rick Emerson, like in the opening? And I think the answer is 79.
You say your own name a lot.
It really is true. I didn't really... Here's the thing. It is not actually intentional, Dawn Taylor. See, there I am, saying a name. It's not my own. By the way, you can reach her. It's Dawn at rickemerson.com. Dawn at rickemerson.com. It wasn't really a thing that I did, you know,
It wasn't like I set out to do it that way. It's just over the years, there were just more and more things with my name in them that kind of accumulated. And so here we now are at the end of 2010, where like every third phrase that comes out of my mouth ends in Emerson or Rick or rickemerson.com.
Yeah, we could have called this, you know, the Don Taylor Show, but first of all, probably not as many people would have listened. But, you know, it didn't have to be called.
Just for variety's sake?
Yeah.
I suppose that's true.
We had actually knocked around a few different names that did not have your name in the title, and then ultimately decided, no, we should actually...
But then I looked in the mirror and I said, no, come on.
And you said, come on, it's me.
It's got to be named after me. Anyway, fools. You can also engage with us via the text box if you'd like it. RickEmerson.com. It's 503-505-6964. Here's what's coming out today. Penis watch. Really? So I looked over at the board. So every day we get ready for the show. Dawn goes over with a marker to the dry erase board. And a dry erase board, which, by the way, I am so exceptionally happy with. That is one of the best purchases. I mean, really, when you talk about your cost-benefit ratio, that was $20. And it was worth... This is the hellish trip I had to make it to Vancouver to get it. Not hellish just because it was in Vancouver. It was like on the hottest day of the year, and I was stuck in traffic. It took me 55 minutes just to get to whatever it is, the I-5, the thing where you go into the path Jansen Beach, and another 25 minutes. I mean, I'm saying all told, it was probably two and a half hours to go to Vancouver, get that dry erase board from some guy who wasn't answering the phone, and so I just stood on his, like, thatched-out, crabgrass-filled lawn in front of his house.
Yelling, hey!
Seriously, like...
I'm here for the... board.
And I was actually just about to open the gate into his backyard and go wander onto his property because there was just no way I was going home without it. You know how much I paid for this dry erase board?
$20.
$20. That's what I'm saying. The $20 well spent,
yeah,
right there.
Because it's huge.
I mean,
and we really could not function as well as we do if we didn't have it.
The dry erase board is all. It is the alpha and the omega, the beginning and the end.
We write our guests are going to be on there, and when they think about it, Sarah and Greg write if they're going to be here in the morning or the afternoon.
So apparently they're going to be taping 9 a.m. on September 8th.
Yeah.
Just in case anybody's wondering.
And I write what the watches are going to be, and we have to add Squires to the list of
fine business partners with whom we are allied.
Which is written on there, just so in case you forget, you can look over, and there it is.
So it says Penis Corpse Snuff. So we have a Penis Watch, Corpse Watch Snuff Watch, which is almost but not exactly the same as yesterday. So for a minute, I was just wondering if I was having a strange deja vu, but we have, in fact, another Snuff Watch. Mm-hmm. We have a Penis Watch coming up today, Snuff Watch coming up today. Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be in the studio with us. Message in the text box here via Skype says, you could have named the show When Mommy and Daddy Fight. All right. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be here talking about The Social Network, which is the new David Fincher, Aaron Sorkin film, and so forth. Dawn Taylor has another installment of Pop Culture Authority. Today's Pop Culture Authority answers the magical question. So I apologize, by the way, to the guy who I emailed last night saying, absolutely, we're going to get to your TV season question today, paying subscriber Michael, because that's what we do. We wouldn't possibly say we were going to do that and then have lied about it. So it's not so much lying as it was just, it wasn't true. So today, Pop Culture Authority, Dawn Taylor will answer the question, from where does the phrase, or as you've got it written here, from where does the phrase, let the cat out of the bag, come? So today, Pop Culture Authority answers the phrase, from where does the phrase, come out of the, cat out of the bag, from where does that come? So where does that, and it's got a weird line break, there's all kinds of strange syntax going on here. Well, in any event, Dawn Taylor is also tracking the following stories for you on this Wednesday.
Jimmy Carter is going to spend second night in an Ohio hospital. A man finds a mouse baked in his bread. And the food stamp a study on food stamps shows the middle class isn't doing too well.
All right, so that is all on the way. And so forth. We have, I got a top five that I set aside, but I'm not even really going to push it all that hard because there's a lot to do and not a lot of time in which to do it. So that is all headed your way in the immediate future. You didn't leave, here's the thing, I don't mean any disrespect with this. You didn't leave that food in here, did you?
What food?
The food, were you eating that food just now?
Yeah, I still have
the casserole
here.
Is this the food that you were complaining about?
Well, I wasn't really complaining. It just took me by surprise.
Okay. This is the tuna casserole.
I made tuna casserole last
night. Were the proportions off? Was that the thing? Not enough noodles? Too much tuna fish?
Well, oh God.
Because that's a thing. Here's the thing about tuna fish, though, as a food, and not that I'm opposed to it. I had a tuna melt last night, as a matter of fact. I'm a huge fan of that because it's inexpensive. It's good for you. And it has protein to power my my massive planet-sized brain. The thing about it is, though, that's a thing where if you're mixing it with something else or if it's just prepared in the wrong way somehow, it just becomes terrible almost immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of those things that I buy a lot of my food products at Cash and Carry, which is the wholesale
It's like a restaurant
grocer.
Supply place,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And I found that tuna, which, you know, tuna is a fairly inexpensive food anyway, but it's really cheap if you buy, like, a giant can of tuna. Like, it's like this big.
Really? Like an industrial? It never occurred to me. They have the industrial-sized cans there.
Right. A restaurant-sized can of tuna.
How much could I expect to pay for one of those?
I don't know. $4?
Are you guessing? Are you?
I can't remember.
Are you doing that politician thing right now, where I ask you how much a quart of milk is, and you go $1?
Yeah, because a lot of things that we buy, I send my husband to go get, and then
good for you.
And so I don't really pay too much attention. I just know that it is much
cheaper. Yeah, okay.
It's really cheap. And what's interesting about it, by the way, is that I think we had talked about this before, and you didn't realize that they cook the tuna inside the can.
I had no idea.
Yeah, at the processing press, they cut up the fish, and then they cut it into can-sized pieces of raw fish, put them in the cans, and then the cans go into the hot, steamy bath thing, and they actually cook them inside the can. Well, when you have, with the big can, it's the same thing. There's like one or two or three big pieces of tuna and that they dump in this can and they cook it. So it's weird because it doesn't flake up all tiny. Like,
right.
you'll get these huge chunks of tuna. But anyway, I made some tuna salad. But then I had like a whole lot of tuna left over. Then we made some tuna casserole. Then we ate the tuna casserole. And I still had tuna left over because it's a huge can of tuna. So I made another tuna casserole last night. But it was one of those things that happens, like this happens at the, like sometimes with boxes of cereal. It's like you have too much, a little bit more than you actually need. But if you don't use all of it, you won't have enough left over to do anything with.
Right.
So I ended up using all of it, going, well, I'll just use all of this tuna in the tuna casserole. And so, yeah, so when I had some leftover tuna casserole here for my lunch, and I took a bite of it, and I went, because I'd kind of forgotten, and it's very tuna-y.
And you just made the weirdest noise. It was like somebody was trying to force-feed you a tire, and you kind of going, ugh! And then I looked over, and it looked as though it were still sitting here. And I was just, here's the thing about tuna casserole. Not so much with, like, tuna salad, but tuna casserole, it's like eggs. I was talking to somebody. It was at Outlook Portland on Monday, and there is one of the women who works at the CW Northwest 32 for Outlook Portland. She has this morning ritual because there's a kitchen there, and she has this ritual where she makes her breakfast at the TV studio and she eats there at her desk while she's checking her mail or whatever. And her breakfast, because she's kind of OCD about this, and I guess she's like trying to lose weight or whatever. But she has some sort of diet, and it involves boiling two eggs and then having the two hard-boiled eggs in the morning as she's sort of catching up on her paperwork and whatever. But, you know, I had this realization that there are certain foods that only smell good if you are eating them. And if other people are eating them, and it's because the boiled egg is the same thing. If you're having the boiled egg, which is not like I do it a lot or whatever, I mean, you know, it's fine. You don't really notice it. If somebody in the room with you is eating a boiled egg, it's just the worst thing on earth. It's just an utterly repellent smell. I don't know why that is. It's like a whole thing about how you can't tickle yourself. There's something in your brain where like a switch flips and certain things you sort of are attuned to and certain things you are not, depending on whether or not you were taking part in them.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why I don't eat hot food here when we're working.
Because it carries and it's weird.
Because I don't want to inflict my food. Because I'm kind of weird about smelling other people's food.
Yeah.
It doesn't drive me crazy, but I kind of dislike it.
See, and it
shouldn't,
though.
So then I don't want to inflict it on other people.
See, that's a thing, though. Do you ever notice that it bothers you, but it shouldn't? Like, it's a thing that presumably you shouldn't care about one way or the other. Shouldn't have any effect on you.
It's contextual for me. It's entirely contextual. If I go to a movie and I smell popcorn, I'm fine. Because my brain knows popcorn smells at the movies. This makes sense. If I'm in a restaurant, if I'm at some place where people are eating foods and they're all around me eating foods, then I understand there will be food smells and it doesn't bother me. But if the food smell is like inappropriate to where I am,
right?
Like if I'm at the movies and somebody is eating one of those hot dogs Or like some of those places where they have pizza that they'll like heat up, give you hot pizza. And the person in front of me is eating pizza, and I'm smelling pizza while sitting in a movie theater. I find it really, really irritating because it just doesn't belong there. And so, yeah, so it's, I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to sit here, like, I'm eating the tuna casserole cold because I didn't want to heat it up, and I didn't want the whole room to smell like hot tuna casserole, because that would be fine for me. I'm eating it. But you don't want to smell that.
All right, thank you. And I appreciate your sensitivity in this matter. I do. No, seriously, Eddie, because it's one of those things that you almost don't like to complain about. I mean, I like to complain about it because complaining is sort of my raison d'etre. But it's a thing. You know what it is? Complaining about something like that is when you talk about a really, really terrifying dream you had last night. As much as you're aware that it was terrifying to you, you also are equally aware that no one else finds it terrifying. It doesn't matter what the dream was, what it was about, what happened. Everybody else finds it either dull or ludicrous or finds you silly for talking about
it. The food smell thing for me, too, it's another one of those things like not too long ago I was with my husband and we were driving through a coffee kiosk and I was getting a coffee beverage and I handed Patrick, he was giving me my change back and he was going to put like money in the tip jar. And I was like, wait. And he's like, what? I said, well, don't tip her now. She's got her back to you. And he's like, well, what do I care? He's like, you want them to see you give them the tip. Otherwise, what's the point? And he's like, who are you, George Costanza? And I started to realize, in many ways, yes.
You're not
yes,
even,
I am.
You're not so much George Costanza as you are Larry David, really.
I mean, that's
the thing. No, I do exactly the same thing. I always make a really... God, we're such retards. Whenever I go and I get change... Especially if it's a chick helping me, I will make the big flamboyant like. It's like
sticking this dollar in the tip jar.
It's like the dollar bill is wet and I have to wave it around to dry it. Hold on a second, let me be. And I'm doing like a fan dance, like I'm belly dancing with the dollar bill. Look at this dollar that I'm going to give you. I have a dollar. Look at that. I'm giving it to you now, which is.
If you put the tip in and they don't see you put the tip in, then don't you have this moment where you just go...
They think I'm a jackass.
Or you just go, well, that was a waste of a dollar.
Totally, exactly, because then I'm not able to get the dollar's worth of thanks and respect that I
exactly.
that are my due.
They don't realize that I just did something nice for them.
A-holes. All right. See, I'm glad that I have you to talk to about this, because a lot of people have these same issues. But they have no one with whom to be. There's no one wants to bring it up in public because in polite society, it's considered weird or strange to have these conversations, but not here. Speaking of weird or strange conversations, I just want to read this real quickly. This is from listener Rachel. I hope this isn't one of those things where I get to the end. She says, don't say my name. I'm listening live right now. I wanted to say, you know what else you talk a lot about, Rick? Your house. So much, in fact, that your house, Rick, made an appearance in one of my dreams last night. Speaking of creepy dreams, I remember walking through my old neighborhood and coming across a house that I knew people never visited. It was a blue two-story house with a red door and spiders all over the place. You couldn't even walk on the sidewalk without going through a web with a spider in it, and I thought, no wonder people never come to this house. At some point in the dream, I ended up, quote, visiting and coming back inside, to which I discovered Rick had his house laid out without any walls or doors in order to reduce effort of any kind. Seriously.
I'm so tired of having to walk across the room to go through an actual door. I'm not going to have any walls in my house.
I'm going to live in a giant shed. Not only that, there was a toilet by itself sitting in one corner, and Rick would then sit on the edge of his bed and chat with you as you sat on the toilet. That's all I can remember from the dream, but enough to sufficiently creep me out and probably you as well. It was very weird. Thanks for this wonderful show, for all the crazy things you put into my brain. Love you guys, Rachel. So there you go. So that's Rachel. All right. Well, there you go. I don't feel like I can really top that. I was just... The only observation I was going to make, and this is a thing that... I don't know if you can identify with this or not, because I do think that this is typically more of a guy thing. But, you know, I told you my wife is moving all the furniture around in the living room, and she had this... It's that thing... You know, we talk about Squires Electric, who are one of our fine business partners here, and how they, you know, they'll come to your house and they'll wire up... You know, your light bulbs or your outlet or your, you know, Ethernet or, you know, if you're in an office where you got like the paging system, the, you know, the intercom or whatever. And we're getting to this point. Do you ever just see your future old self starting to emerge? Like you start to suss out just little things about your personality you realize, like, okay, I'm not old or feeble or crippled or senile yet, but it's like that day is coming, and it's closer to the end now than it is the beginning for me. And that happens to me every time I find myself momentarily flummoxed or perplexed by electronic equipment. A computer. And the thing is, it doesn't have with computers all that often. I'm still pretty savvy in terms of computers. It's not like I'm some hacker or cracker or whatever. But it's like, you know, if I need to figure out how to download something or how to do something with my Mac or how to, you know, if I need to... Or even as dumb as this sounds, my searching abilities online to figure out the answer or to find... I'm pretty good at finding out the solution myself to some sort of computer glitch. You know what screws me, though, is my home stereo or, like, televisions. If I'm having to set something up or it's, like, walking you through the setup process or, like, how to program your remote to control everything in your house. And it's like, place remotes end-to-end. Now enter access code. Now press and hold until red light blinks twice. Once red light blinks twice, enter code as found in back of book. Wait for light to blink once, then to turn solid. And I'm going, wait, what? I don't... Hold on. What? Stop. Too fast. And then I'm having to play... I was doing this last night with my iPhone, and don't get me wrong, I love my iPhone. I was trying to load a custom ringtone last night, and I got used to doing it on the BlackBerry, and so now I'm the old guy that knows the way to do it on the thing they don't make anymore, but I didn't know how to do it on the thing they make now. I swear to Christ, this is how old I have become. I found myself watching a YouTube video last night where they step-by-step tell you how to put a ringtone on your phone. And I was so glad, it was like 3 a.m, and I was so glad that no one was awake to see me, because at one point I just sat there and I just hung my head and I just went, God damn it. And then, but then it was like I was halfway through the process and I had to continue. So I was doing that last night. That was on the heels of having this whole business with my stereo system in the front room where Lara has rearranged all the furniture, and it's that thing where I've lost track of what plugs into what, like what the chain is, what the order of plugs is, because the television hooks to the Xbox, but it's like the Xbox is also hooked to the stereo, so you can listen, you know, so when you play a video game or whatever, or like Netflix or something on the Xbox, it comes out of the stereo, but then it's like, but then the Xbox picture has to get back to the television somehow, even though the Xbox itself is plugged into the stereo, so then the stereo needs to go to the television. But the stereo also has to go into my home office because it goes into the speakers that are set up there. And I realize that all of the cables are just sitting on the floor and I have no idea what plugs into anything. And it's just going to be a long night of me wiring things together and nothing working. And then having to do it in every possible combination. Also, now because I have moved because the Xbox and the stereo are now on opposite sides of the room, and it's a whole long conversation. But the point is that I now... I swear to Christ, if I could tally the number of hours I have spent in my life driving to a Radio Shack, wandering around inside a Radio Shack, and driving home from a Radio Shack, only to realize I still lack the one adapter that I need. Where it's like, well, it's a single male, it's a double female. If only that was what I needed. Which is the same thing that happens here, by the way. And I noticed in the UPS today dropped off another mixing board for us this morning. Which means that I will inevitably find myself here. I don't know why there isn't a Radio Shack available 24 hours a day. I swear to God, I would pay a 500% markup. I would do almost anything to have a place that sold, and I don't mean like Fred Meyer, and even they close at like midnight, but a place where you could buy like patch cables and cords and accessories available anytime day or night. Because every guy, and you probably are the same way, where you have a box of cables or cords or switches or adapters or patch cables, and you have every single combination of audio and video cables and adapters except for the one you need. And if you do have the one you need, you only have one and you need two.
But don't you feel great, though, on those rare occasions that you do have the right one?
I do.
When you have this thing going, wait a minute, I do have a coax that's that long. And then, I'm victorious.
It really is a great feeling. And it's one of my most frequently used analogies is... And this happened, I think, 2 weeks ago when we were trying to we've added some additional audio processing to our stream here because we don't like to deafen people when things are quiet and then they suddenly get loud. And I was here trying to set up the processor late one night, and I realized that it wasn't quite working. And so I took that big drawer up there of cables and I dumped them all out on the floor, Apollo 13 style. And I said to myself, all right, this is what we've got to work with. Can we build it? And it took me an hour and a half, but I will be goddamned if I didn't string together cables in a fashion that was adequate and sufficient to get us through the night to the next day when the Radio Shack opened. It was just the most glorious feeling, but that's so rarely the case. Anyway, so that was my night.
I don't understand it, because when we have situations like that at my house, it's one of these weird things that my husband understands how the TV hooks to the DVD player, hooks to the cable outlet, hooks to the stereo, which is something I have never been able to figure out. Right. But when it comes to something involving the computer, he has no idea how it works. But he still insists on trying. And then I'm the one who just finally ends up going, give it to me. No, the router plugs into this. And he doesn't believe that I know what I'm talking about because I don't know how the other things work.
Right.
And yet, for some reason, I understand the computer part, but he doesn't get that. And you'd think that they would be so similar that if you understood how one system worked, you'd understand how the other system worked.
No, but that's not how your brain operates, though.
No.
I can tell you, though, and there's any number of guys in the audience right now, and probably not a few women, who find it hot that you know how all the computer stuff works. Mm-hmm. I have to, years and years ago, one of my many, 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 many former producers, Christina, when Christina Carlson worked on the show, I remember I was trying to, I was back at my desk back at KOTK, and I was trying to get on the internet or make something work, and I don't know, there's something going wrong, and she's like, well, let me take a look. And she was a very feminine, very, I wouldn't say she was tiny, even like a tiny petite little girl or whatever. She was like a real life Smurfette sort of though. I mean, she really was. She's a Christian youth minister, if that gives you any idea. But immediately she dropped on the ground and laid on her back underneath my desk and was taking out all the wiring and pulling the motherboard out of my computer. And I said, what are you doing? And she goes, oh, I used to do Ethernet wiring and motherboard installation in college, you know, for extra money. And it was just the hottest thing, which I couldn't say at the time because it would have been awkward. But it was the hottest thing ever. So, all right. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week is going to be here in just a skosh. Penis Watch, Corpse Watch, Snuff Watch, Pop Culture Authority, and more. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program at the News Desk. This is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the News Desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Former President Jimmy Carter will spend a second night in an Ohio hospital for additional medical observation after being whisked from an airplane to an emergency room with an upset stomach. President Carter's in very good spirits, appreciates all the good wishes being sent his way, and looks forward to getting back to his busy schedule.
He's up and joking officials. With physicians and family members.
Hospital spokeswoman Susan Christopher declined to say whether Carter's condition had worsened since he was admitted for stomach problems on Tuesday morning. Carter became ill during a Delta Airlines flight from Atlanta to Cleveland, causing rescue crews to rush him to the hospital after the plane landed. Carter's medical team recommended that he stay a second night for additional monitoring. Earlier Wednesday, a hospital official said Carter was feeling normal and continued to be observed by doctors. The recession spread poverty into thousands of households where good jobs had been common, a study of food stamp use in Oregon concludes. The study from Oregon State University compared first-time food stamp users in 2009 and in 2005, when Oregon's economy was better. It found outsized increases in such categories as adult males who had lost manufacturing or construction jobs, households that hadn't used food stamps, and households that reported sharp drops in income. The findings were not a surprise. Even as the recession was easing, food stamp use was rising, with 1 in 6 Oregonians using them. The study found that even though households headed by single women still outnumbered those headed by two adults, the number of two-adult households starting food stamps was 50% greater than 4 years earlier, while the number of households headed by single women and starting food stamps was 37% lower.
And so food stamps, that's like that, because they're not even really stamps anymore, that's like that Oregon Trail card thing, right? You and I've had that food stamp conversation where you said you've never, you've never done that, right? And is that like a whole, I don't want to be on the dole
thing? I think so, yeah. I just was never able to make that jump to go.
You've taken unemployment.
Yeah, I've taken unemployment.
Okay, so but you draw a mental, which is, I think a lot of people do, you draw a mental distinction between the two.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I mean, there have
Which
been,
is weird because you pay into the food stamp system, but you don't pay into the unemployment system.
Yeah, I mean, there's no real reason. There have been times in my life when I certainly would have been, it would have been applicable.
That's
I
your cheese, Dawn, and if you don't eat it, they're just going to keep it.
I just never did. I don't know.
All right.
I'd like to say it's pride, but I don't really have a lot of pride. It's more just some kind of weird fixation that one doesn't do that.
I have no further observations about it. I was just sort of, it's just curious because I, It is odd the way that we draw those lines, and it's also odd when you go to the like a plaid pantry and you actually see the list of things that it's available for and it's not available for.
Yeah,
I remember being all really like angry for no reason because like it's you know I'm not on food stamps and you know whatever, but going there and saying that you could actually use it to buy Red Bull but not Viso, and then I just got all like torqued off for the rest of the day because apparently there was they had so many people who were purchasing you know like the vitamin drinks and energy drinks and whatever that they had to put down. They had to put down like a whole like next to the, you know, we need ones and fives sign, like a whole thing differentiating what you could buy with it. And like I would say every other week at least, I find myself standing behind a guy who still thinks you can buy cigarettes with it. I am always behind that guy.
Yeah, you think people would
know,
right?
Known.
They would just say in big red letters, "Is it you can't buy booze or cigarettes?"
Seriously, even though when you think about it, really, the people on food stamps are that. You know, I mean, you need booze more than most people if you're on food stamps. Those are the people who need alcohol. We had to do a booze drive for the unemployed.
Yeah.
You know, everybody does clothing drives, toy drives. You know, they do drives for food. I'm not saying those things are unimportant. I'm saying it's handled. You know, not that the problem is solved, but there's so many organizations who are raising money, you know, for those sorts of things, that we would just be crowding the field. We had to totally do a booze drive.
How would you figure out who to distribute it to?
Who to distribute it? You turned into... You turned to the theater Geisel
well,
there.
I'm just thinking. You can see the, when you ask people to come by and bring their new unopened bottles of booze to give to the needy. But I mean, how do you decide who gets them?
I don't know. Well, how do they decide who gets all the other stuff? Like, how do they decide who gets toys when they do like toys for tots or whatever?
Well, they go to like hospitals and certain nonprofit charities that give away things to families.
But
and
I mean,
stuff like that. But the thing is, I think if you took a big box of booze to like say the Salvation Army, they'd probably say, oh, that's not a very good idea.
But somebody eventually, like if you donate whatever, you donate a toy, at some point. At some place in the chain, there's a guy who determines whether or not you are eligible to receive it. So I don't know what mechanism they use. It probably is just like the honor system. I mean, I guess, which maybe works better for things for your child than for booze.
Well, I know that in St. Helens, when I worked at the newspaper there, we were involved with a local thing that was area families could fill out a thing and say they have a child who wanted to get a toy from this program, and then they would hang the kid's name like it was a little hanger, like an ornament on a tree that was like at the Walmart or something like that. And then you would go and you would take it, and it said on it whether it was a boy or girl, about how old they are, and what sort of toys they would like. And then you would buy the toy and wrap it and put their name on it, and then you were donating specifically to that one person. I suppose, you know, we could have people, you know, apply to the booze donation program. They could tell us, you know, what they used to do, what their job was, and what sort of booze they prefer, and then we could try to hook them up with booze donors for Christmas.
We could just say, you know, the holidays are the wrong time to go without precious alcohol.
Exactly.
Especially if you're unemployed or homeless. All right, I have to file that away. It seems like we had to workshop that a little bit before we roll it out publicly. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Here is Don Taylor.
Shocked Stephen Force went to make sandwiches for his kids and found a dead mouse embedded in his loaf of bread. Stephen, 41, bought the Hovis Best of Both at a Tesco and had already used several slices when he made the discovery. The dad of four from Kidlington, Oxfordshire in Britain said, "I felt quite ill and even worse when an environmental health officer said the tail was missing. I wondered if we'd eaten that earlier." None of the family fell ill. Premier Foods was fined for failing to maintain acceptable standards at their site in South London. A spokesman said, "We apologize profusely."
Was it it was a loaf of bread?
Yes.
Well, it seems unlikely they'd eaten the tail then.
I have a really good, really gorgeous, big color photograph of the mouse in the bread that I'm going to post
fantastic.
To our site. And there's a smaller black and white representation of it. But the photo is actually much larger, and you can, in color, you can see the details
of
the mouse.
Okay, so this is not at all what I...
This is not a hoax. This isn't a guy who's pretending to have found a mouse in his bread. No, this is the corner of a loaf of a sandwich bread, and the corner is a dead mouse.
Well, here's literally what it is. It's like I guess these are slices of bread I'm looking at, not the whole loaf. It is as though the mouse is a gargoyle perched in the corner. It's like the bread is a building, you know, it's squarish and it's got the corners, and the mouse is a gargoyle put there to ward off spirits. That's exactly what this looked like. So you said the tail is missing, and I was thinking, well, surely you would have noticed if you'd eaten the tail, but maybe not if it was baked in this way, especially if the tail gets a little crisp,
And it depends on, you know, what kind of sandwich meats you're using.
Oh,
it
boy.
It could be the same texture.
See, I thought it was sort of that, you know, the mouse had, like, eaten its way into the loaf of bread while it was, you know, while it was maybe being made or something, and so it was right in the center. No, this is the sort of thing that you would... You might actually take a big bite out of this without noticing.
Yeah, and then you unwrap and you go, what? You get further down into your loaf of bread and go, what is that? Oh, my God, you say.
The mouse does seem to have, I mean, I'm anthropomorphizing here, but the mouse does seem to have a sort of expression like, if I can just make it to the, crap. And then it was just, you know, sealed in.
Ouch,
All right, so that'll be available at rickemerson.com/pictures here in just a moment. rickemerson.com/pictures. You go to visual aids for September 29th. 2010, you'll see a photo of this. And did you say it's quote, a large,
it's
gorgeous
a,
color photograph?
It is.
Awesome.
It is being sent right now, so it should show up shortly.
Fantastic. This photograph of a mouse baked into some bread that a guy probably ate is brought to you by Squires Electric, a brand new business partner here at the Rick Emerson Program at Emerson News Network. First and foremost, you can find out more about them at SquiresElectric.com. SquiresElectric.com. And I mentioned the Bob Vila Time Life, you know, home repair system or whatever. Yeah. Those, like, your first book, Kitchens and Bathrooms, will arrive at what... And by the way, that's a pop culture reference where, like, no one on earth understands, knows what the second book is. Nobody ever orders the second book. It's like when they say, you know, your first book, Henry Lee Lucas, will arrive with... But you really only ever get the first book. And then, you know, that's the thing where you realize that you're paying, you know, like, $49 for a book in, like, diamond-tufted leatherette that you don't really need. So somebody asked me if I actually owned any of the Time Life Home Improvement books, if that was just a thing I was saying as a wacky gag. And the answer is that I do, in fact, somewhere in my basement, I have the Time Life Kitchens and Bathrooms book, which is the first one you got on the set.
Nice.
Now, I didn't order it, like, off the television. It wasn't like I saw Bob Vila and said, even I am not fool enough to think that I am capable of fixing things around the house. But I saw it, in like a Goodwill or something, where all of those things inevitably end up. And I said, by God, I have to own that because it's a living, breathing piece of pop culture history. So I have that in my house. I don't actually use the Time Life book to sort of figure out how I'm going to fix my house. I don't try to fix my own house. I would not be here doing this radio program if I tried to fix my house. I would just be dead. And so you've probably realized at some point in your life that you're really not a person who needs to be, you know, trying to winch open like a power box at home so you can fix it.
Oh, no. I've done some small, easy-to-do, like, plumbing repairs and things like that. But electricity is something that I don't want to touch at all. It just scares me too much.
As the public service announcement says, don't go fooling around with electricity. That's not a thing you need to do because that'll end badly for you. So what you want to do is you want to contact Squire Electric at SquiresElectric.com, or you can call them at 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. It's free estimates, no job too small, no job too large. They've done everything from a single light socket to a large condominium to a full office building, and they are a Portland business, not like a franchise, not like some massive company just, set up shop here and just plop them down. They are a business grown here in Portland, operating here in Portland. Squires Electric, a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson radio program. At the news desk, here is Dawn Taylor.
Let's do our snuff watch.
Fantastic. Here's your snuff watch for whatever this is, for Wednesday, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Here is Dawn Taylor with your snuff watch.
Director Arthur Penn, a mythmaker and mythbreaker who in such classics as Bonnie and Clyde and Little Big Man refashioned movie in American history and sealed a generation's affinity for outsiders, died last night, the day after his 88th birthday. His daughter Molly Penn said her father died at his home in Manhattan of congestive heart failure. His longtime friend and business manager, Evan Bell, said today that Penn had been ill for almost a year and that a memorial service will be held before the end of the year. Penn's older brother was photographer Irving Penn, who died in October of last year. After making his name on Broadway as director of Tony Award-winning plays The Miracle Worker and All the Way Home, Penn rose as a film director in the 1960s. Bonnie and Clyde was a big hit for him. Little Big Man told the tale of the conquest of the West with the Indians as the good guys. He once said, A society would be wise to pay attention to the people who do not belong if it wants to find out where it's failing.
I saw Little Big Man when I was, when I was fairly young. It was on television. I must have been maybe 11 or 12. And in retrospect, it seems sort of strange that it was just on broadcast television. It does, it's not like a big mainstream appeal film, and it's a little unconventional. But I remember just thinking, and I was not really old enough to grasp all of the subtext, but just thinking it wasn't quite like anything I'd ever seen before. And I didn't know it was the same guy who did Bonnie and Clyde, though.
Yeah, I'm rereading Peter Biskin's Raging Bulls and Easy Riders right now, and it's interesting because I just read through the part where Warren Beatty was getting Bonnie and Clyde made, and that he had the writers had originally wanted Francois Truffaut to do it. They were huge fans of the French New Wave, and eventually they ended up going with Arthur Penn as the director. And I guess he and Warren Beatty just fought vociferously, arguing at the top of their lungs about everything, every step of the way through the process. But it was sort of an amiable arguing in that they weren't arguing because they hated each other. They were arguing because they both genuinely wanted the best thing out of this movie entirely. And so he also did an adaptation of The Miracle Worker with the Oscar-winning performance by Anne Bancroft. He directed The Missouri Breaks with Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson, Night Moves with Gene Hackman, Alice's Restaurant. He originally directed Beatty in Mickey One, which was a gangster film that wasn't really very good, but that's why Beatty hired him to do Bonnie and Clyde. But yes, Arthur Penn is dead at 88.
There is your Snuff Watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. All right. By the way, I should have known better than to look, but that mouse photo is even more disturbing in color.
Oh, it's up there now. It wasn't up there right away. So
I'm looking at it right now. It's completely off-putting.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like I'm not really. Most of the thing, people have been sending me horrible pictures and movies telling me about dreams in which my house is filled with toilets and covered with spiders or whatever, and for so long that almost nothing bothers me. This is really legitimately disturbing. I can't look away. I actually have to just close the window. It keeps drawing my eye. So there you go. You can see that RickEmerson.com/pictures. That's
then you keep clicking on it and it will get big. No, and then it's like, he looks like he's praying.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Please
to the bread god above. All right. You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. We got Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week coming up later on. Also, Corpse Watch, Penis Watch, and in just a few moments, Pop Culture Authority. Here's Don Taylor.
Google has been convicted of defaming a French computer user after the internet technology giant linked his name to the word rapist in automatic web searches. The convicted sex offender, who cannot be named for legal reasons, was found to have been defamed by the search engine's suggest function. Court documents said the function, which suggests options and phrases as a user types, linked the man's identity to words including rapist, Satanist, rape, and prison. According to French reports, the man was convicted of the corruption of a minor and sentenced to 3 years in jail earlier this year. Despite appealing his conviction, the man discovered his name was linked by the search function to the phrases.
Wait a minute, so he is or is not an actual sex offender? I'm confused about this now.
He's appealed his conviction. He was convicted.
Okay. So he's convicted, but I guess in the French legal system, if you're appealing, then maybe the conviction doesn't have the full force then yet.
Well, in what is believed to be a landmark decision, the Superior Court of Paris found Google guilty of the public slandering of a private individual. Google said it will appeal the decision, which also named Eric Schmidt its chief executive. The court ruled the man had been defamed because he is considered innocent under French law until all of his appeals have been exhausted.
Okay. Have you had much time with Google and that new autocomplete feature of theirs? I got to say, I don't really care for it. It bugs me.
I don't dislike that, but I do dislike this new thing where you choose what you're going to go to, and it goes to the page, and then you get this whole thing, this bar across the top with video options, and I don't get the little bar with what I had typed in anymore.
Are you talking about a thing where it actually changes your search terms for you? It's like an autocomplete or an autocorrection for spelling or something, except it's an autocorrection for what they think you're searching for.
But it also used to be that there was the field in which you would enter what you were looking for. Then it would go to that. And I'm okay with their, hey, would you choose one of these things or whatever? That's fine. But now it's like you say, yes, look for this for
right.
me. It goes to the page and the field to type the stuff in disappears, which used to be in there. It used to still be there. And it had what you had typed still there. So if you go, okay, that's not exactly what I was looking for, you can go just change a word or two in the field of what you had typed for. That's gone now. So if I want to, like, change my search terms, I have to now
go back,
backtrack to the page before. And it's really annoying because I find a lot of times when I'm searching for something, my first try, okay, that's not what I was looking for. Let me rephrase
right,
that.
Right.
And you can't because the field is gone now.
Have you, there's a list going around the internet. It was, I think maybe somebody, I always want to say Wired, but I defaulted it, but I don't think it was Wired. It was somebody, some online site like that had put together a comprehensive list of words and phrases that Google would not autocomplete. And it's, you know, it's usually it's like porn stuff and, you know, and whatever. But it's phrases that if you start typing it into the new Google search function, it will actually, it blacklists them and it will actually make you, it won't suggest things. For example, if you just write, I hate, it will not help you complete the end of that. Also on the list, Jews are, and strangely enough, the word lesbian. If you just write the word lesbian, they will not help you out. Like, there may be stuff about, you know, the lesbian lifestyle on the internet, but Google's not going to assist you in finding it. They are not going to suggest. They're not going to opine in any way about lesbian information.
The first thing, actually, Patton Oswalt did a thing in his stand-up at one point where he was talking about texting his wife. His wife had sent him a text and said something, and he said, I love you, and he was going to respond to her, whatever it was. And he typed in, I, and his phone immediately, like, auto-suggested, hate. And you realize that I type the phrases I hate into my phone so often that it just assumes that the next thing I'm going to say is I hate. And he's like, yeah. And then through some fumbling of buttons, he ended up just hitting send and sent that back to his wife. And he realized he hadn't even said, I hate you. It was just like he was some kind of like crazed animal that his wife writes, I love you. And he responds, I hate.
It's fantastic. Does your phone, well, not your phone, because your phone is basically just made out of clay.
Yes, but it does that thing where it suggests words
but does
for
it,
me.
But it doesn't learn, though.
I think it does.
Really?
Yeah, I think if you do something, if you type in a, like I'm doing the thumb thing while I'm talking, if you type in a specific, like, combination of phrases,
it commits
a number
it to,
of
like,
times,
virtual memory?
Yeah, it goes, oh, you often say, you know, like, with me, it's a lot of, like, I'll be, and then it just immediately types in, few minutes late, because it knows that that's what I'm going
to
say.
Have you ever typed your own name into Google just to see, like, what it suggests as an autocomplete or what it suggests as a result?
No, not since they did this.
You ought to do that at some point. Or, you know, where you just take, like, the first, you know, the first few words of any sentence that pops into your head and just see what the completion is. Like, there was the one, I think, in the article where the guy just typed in, like, he typed in Kentucky or, like, you know, where... You know, like Kentucky is whatever, and the list of suggested sentences really gives you a window into how deeply stupid America is. One of the suggestions was, "What state is Kentucky in?" Which just makes you weep for teachers and schools and like everyone. Are you prepared with pop culture authority?
I am indeed.
All right, so we'll do that in just one moment here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We come back on the other side with Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week, still to come. Penis Watch, and I don't know if we have time. We may get to the top five, but if not, then that will be later on this week. Tomorrow, our guests will include Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show right here on the Emerson News Network.
From where does the phrase, let the cat out of the bag, come?
From the Emerson News Network. This is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Dawn Taylor. Try as you might, sometimes you just can't keep a secret. You may tell your best friend that they're on their way to a surprise birthday party, or warn a coworker that they're about to be fired. You're doing what we call letting the cat out of the bag. But how did this phrase originate? Why do we associate letting slip a secret with releasing a feline from a sack? The most widely believed theory is that it comes from an unscrupulous practice by con men who had claimed to be selling a pig that had been placed, for some reason, in a closed bag. But when the buyer returned home and opened the sack, they would find that they had instead purchased a cat, which is, of course, much less valuable than a pig. While this explanation is widely circulated, even appearing in a number of books on the etymology of slang phrases, it doesn't make any sense. How could someone mistake a cat for a pig, even if it was inside a sack? Cats are smaller. They weigh less. They would make angry cat noises and thrash about inside the bag. In fact, this theory may be confusing the phrase, let the cat out of the bag, with the homily, don't buy a pig in a poke, which warns against buying items that you haven't examined first. Another better theory suggests that the phrase comes from the British Royal Navy, where a cat of nine tails might be used to correct the behavior of an errant sailor. To let the cat out of the bag would be to remove the lash for punishment. But it's still difficult to ascertain how that applies to revealing a secret. In fact, no one really knows where the phrase comes from. We do know, however, that it's really unlikely that it came from bamboozling pig buyers into buying cats. That's just silly. And if you don't believe us, just try putting a cat inside a bag and convincing someone it's a pig. Go ahead. We dare you.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. All right, immediately the text messages have come in. So let me understand this. Today's pop culture, quote, authority, end quote, says, we don't really know. Followed by, I demand 12 cents, or at least 8. Don, turn out your pockets.
You know, here's the thing, is sometimes the correct answer is no one knows.
That there is no answer.
There is no answer. We have just, like, informed you of the fact that you may be thinking, there's a reason that we say this, and I'm just too stupid and I don't know what it is. Well, you know something? Now you know that there's no answer. And if it comes up, you can say, you know, no one really knows.
You're like an unsatisfying female Paul Harvey.
That I am.
And that phrase is still a mystery. Good day. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Now, page two. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. And you can also email, if you like, it's rick@rickemerson.com or Dawn, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Today's show brought to you by, among other folks, The Cleaning Solution, 971-533-3211. The Cleaning Solution. We will talk more about them later on in the hour. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show from Willamette Week, Mr. Aaron Mesh, screen critic. Screen editor? Screen critic? I never get it right. Not once. Not once have I ever said that correctly.
Let's go with movie editor.
Movie editor. Wait, now are you actually changing the title? Has the title been transmogrified?
The title gets changed sometime this fall.
All right. So your lamentations have been heard.
They have.
Are you going to call David Walker at home and taunt him about it? Your fancy schmancy title's gone now, Mr. Big Man.
That's what I do whenever I'm drunk. I just call Walker and crank call him all night long.
He's sort of a home entertainment center in that way. When he's not getting swine flu, he can just be the recipient of your phone fun. So right out of the gate, you were talking to Cheryl about this. You sent an email. You said that you felt the Social Network, which is the new it's the new Sorkin Fincher film with Jesse. Jesse Eisenberg and Justin Timberlake. You said you felt it was one of the best films of the year.
Oh, by far. Yeah, it's tremendous.
Did you expect it to be going in? Because we've had a lot of the, and I'm all pumped up for it and excited and just it's been just like cranked up for the movie for months. But we get a lot of the, like, why do I want to see a movie about Facebook? Did you have any of that going in?
I was cautiously optimistic based on the pedigree of the cast and the pedigree of the people who wrote and directed it. But it's so much better than I expected.
And so it is basically, we've talked a bit about this, but you having seen it are in a much better position. It's not really about Facebook as such. I mean, it is sort of, I compared it almost to being like a There Will Be Blood kind of a thing, where it really is just about deception and relationships in the business world as they overlap with personal relationships.
Yeah, think of it as a dot-com era Great Gatsby.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
because
a very, very fair way of looking at it.
And is that because of where Zuckerberg is just so intent on... So, I don't know a lot about him.
He's so ambitious, so acidic, so angry at everyone in the world for not keeping up with his speed of thought. And he leaves everyone behind and finds himself on top of the world and very alone.
And there's that. There is that whole thing where it takes place at Harvard where, and again, I don't know much about him and where he comes from, but it doesn't seem like he's a guy of substantial means. I think he's probably one of those, you got into school because he was brilliant, not because he was rich.
The movie doesn't talk about his background, but actually his father was a very successful dentist.
Okay, so it wasn't like he was some destitute kid that just struggled his way into Harvard.
No, his dad was known in like Cleveland as Painless Zuckerberg, the dentist.
Painless Zuckerberg. That's awesome. That's awesome because of the total abject lack of linguistic flow there.
Something to that effect. The New Yorker had it more accurately than that.
Painless Rabinowitz. Get me to Painless Rabinowitz now. And there's this improbable cast of characters in the film who, you know, and however fictionalized or not some of the events may be, there's the Winklevoss twins who are these like huge, like Aryan looking rowing champions that are twin brothers. They're like 6'7". They're twins. They're just all muscled out to here, and they're like Olympic crew champions at Harvard.
All true story, and they basically look like a doubled Brad Pitt. And amazingly, they're both played by the same guy. The actor's name is Armie Hammer, and he is
Armie Hammer is playing the Winklevoss twins.
Yes,
wow.
Armie Hammer as the Winklevoss twins.
Jesus.
But Fincher uses CGI to actually double the performance, you know, Parent Trap style.
Somebody told me, and I don't know if this is true. Somebody told me that the way that Fincher had the CGI was different. That it was actually scenes where he just he took the face off. If there were scenes where he had to have the two guys in the same room, if we couldn't get around it, he actually had like a stand-in, and then he just morphed the face off the one guy onto the other.
Well, that would have been using the same technique he used in Benjamin Button, so that sounds right.
Yeah, I mean, it was just mind-blowing, and apparently you don't notice it at all. Like, if you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't spot it.
I assumed they were two different actors, that he actually found giant Olympic twins.
Get me the Olympic twins, now!
But Justin Timberlake is amazing in this movie.
I'm so glad to see that guy actually being able to act. First thing I saw him in was it Alpha Dog? Is that the movie I'm thinking of?
Yeah, and he's not great in Alpha Dog, although he was always good in Saturday Night Live. Yeah. You remember his Omeletteville performances?
And it seemed like this
is even stronger than his Omeletteville work.
Nothing, you're crazy. Nothing is stronger than Omeletteville. But it seemed like there was a little something there, you know, just from the beginning. And so, but is this the best thing you've seen him do?
Oh, by far. Yeah.
I just sit and nerd myself into a frenzy talking about any of this stuff.
But okay, but he plays Sean Parker, which is one of the funniest jokes I can imagine, just as a casting joke, because Sean Parker's the founder of Napster,
right?
Which destroyed the music industry,
right?
Yes.
So having Justin Timberlake, the best selling platinum artist of the last 10 years, play the guy who destroyed best selling platinum albums is a really, really good joke.
And especially when you consider the fact that NSYNC is the last. They're considered by many people, the No Strings Attached album is considered the last big blockbuster of the pre-file sharing era, because it was the last record to break 1 million copies in its first week. And nobody ever did it again. And they say that is almost totally because of the shift towards file sharing. And that just shows how far that guy has moved beyond. I'm like, I don't know what Chris Kirkpatrick is doing, like, at the moment or whatever. Or that guy with, like, the paint-on beard and the Backstreet Boys. But Justin Timberlake seems to have moved on to a totally separate realm in his life, which is sort of great.
He's really diabolical in this movie.
And again, apparently the real Sean Parker's very much the same way, where it's like he was like this 24-year-old like wunderkind, and like everywhere he went in any city in the country, everybody knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was he had founded and lost 2 multi-billion-dollar startups by the time he was like in his early 20s.
Sure, and allegedly they both went up his nose.
Right. And is there anything in the film you think that they've, because they're all real names, like none of the characters have been changed, there's no, you know, it doesn't seem like there's any composites. I mean, does it seem like the kind of thing that they're going to get sued over by somebody?
Oh, there's a couple things in this movie it feels like they should be, but I don't think they will. I think they've been very, very careful about keeping it as close as possible to what they can find on the record.
And I guess maybe because it's based on that Ben Mezrich book, maybe the brunt of it would go on to him if it's an adaptation.
If anybody's going to get his ass sued, it's going to be Mezrich.
Well, and I'm surprised that he hasn't gotten sued already, because I've talked about this for a couple days now. We've been sort of leading up to the release of this. And Accidental Billionaires, which is the book on which this is based, that was the follow-up to, like, you know, he'd bring into the house and busting Vegas. And I think all of which has sort of been debunked as where he basically just conglomerated like a bunch of crap that he heard, just sort of stories that may or may not be true. But if they are true, it's just coincidental. They were just stories he heard and picked up from people that he never really was able to get corroboration for, and just stitch them together into a book, which is kind of what he did with this. But they do seem to be largely true.
I think a lot of what you'll see in the film, at least, is carefully modulated truth. I don't believe this is the true story of Facebook by any means, but it's actually fairly balanced. It has a certain Rashomon quality where, like, so it's structured so that it's inside the court hearings, depositions.
Right.
So it's structured in a deposition style so that you have these fast forward moments where these characters are all deposing about what happened back in the day at Harvard, 5 years ago. And in every case, you see it from different angles, and it turns out that everybody has a valid gripe, including Zuckerberg.
Does Zuckerberg come off as at least a conflicted guy or a good guy ever? Because he seems like such a blank. If you see him interviewed, he seems like a guy who just doesn't really have a personality, so he just sort of puts this sort of cardboard cutout of himself in front.
I found him immensely sympathetic, but in the way of a guy who's 19 years old and wants to look tough.
Right.
Like, who is smarter than you and is smarter than me and desperately wants people to acknowledge that he is. And so, comes across as a giant a-hole because, you know, it seems like the fastest way to be noticed.
Does it look like a David Fincher film, you know, in that weird, like, filmed through algae kind of way?
It looks like it was filmed through a veneer of steel. It's got like that really metallic sheen to it. That, I mean, you know, like that Seven style gorgeous garbage dump thing happening, which looks really nice. Harvard never looks so cold and scary.
I don't know even if there's anything else opening this week that's important. I mean, is this the only thing that's really on my radar? Is there anything else coming out that matters?
It's good. There's the remake of Let the Right One In called Let Me In.
Oh God. Forgot all about
don't,
that.
Don't go.
No, I will not. In fact, I think we've got some sound on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we do.
So that is a movie which I'm going to steadfastly avoid that.
It's not very good, but it's strangely faithful. It's an almost exact shot-for-shot remake, except, you know, it loses all that's interesting.
Is it just one of those things where it's pointless more than anything else?
I could not understand why they did it.
We have talked about Let the Right One In just forever. Was it you that actually pointed out that the different subtitles?
Yeah.
So there's actually the original Let the Right One In, which if you haven't seen it, is really just a fantastic film. One of the best films I've seen in the last 5 years, period, and really one of the better vampire movies like of all time.
And you had suggested it to Sarah, and she didn't really like it. And then I was coming in every Tuesday to talk about DVDs and stuff, and I mentioned to her, it's like, well, which version did you see? And she's like, what do you mean? Like, well, they later edition had different subtitles and vastly inferior subtitles that just kind of destroyed the entire movie.
And let me tell you, the subtitles in the remake just suck. It's a joke. There's no subtitles
in English. All right. Yeah. We're here with Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. This is Don Taylor
God,
at the
that
news
joke
desk.
Died.
No, I was just. Oh, I'm sorry. That's. You know what? My instant karma though was that I went to play the news sounder and I had it potted down. There we go.
And now,
God punished me right away.
This is Don Taylor.
A new study from the Pew Center for Religion and Public Life finds that many Americans, despite professing a faith, don't know much about their religion. Senior researcher Greg Smith explains how people in different areas of the country stacked up against each other in their knowledge.
If you look at the entire set of 32 religious knowledge questions, people in the South do a little bit worse by about one question than people who live in the Northeast or the Midwest or the West.
Really, let's be honest. Couldn't that just be about any kind of test in any field of knowledge at all, ever, at any time in our country's history?
Smith says there were three groups that scored highest on the 32-question quiz, which led to the study results.
Overall results on the entire set of 32 questions that we asked.
Now, we haven't played the answer to this, and you probably don't know the answer either. I'm wondering if he's talking about three different faiths or three different social groups when he's saying about the three groups who scored the highest. Because I'm wondering if I even dare try to predict them.
I don't know. Right.
Overall results on the entire set of 32 questions that we asked, there are three groups that come out on top. Atheists and agnostics, Mormons and Jews.
I was totally going to go Jew, and I didn't say, I should have just said it out loud.
You should always go Jew.
Damn me!
Overall results on the entire set of 32 questions that we asked, there are three groups that come out on top. Atheists and agnostics, Mormons and Jews. We've been quite struck by that pattern of findings, particularly the strong performance of atheists.
Wait a minute. That's either two groups or four groups. That's not three groups.
Let me get this straight. Atheists and agnostics know the most about their religion. That's a pretty easy question to answer when they're asked, well, what sorts of things do you believe in? You go, nothing.
I think it's about religion in general. I think it is that they are quizzing people on the vast panoply of faith.
Right.
They're not saying, like, no, because that would...
No, I read about this. So, for example, it turns out that, like, 53% of Protestants don't know that Protestantism was founded by Martin Luther.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, I guess that doesn't surprise me. And it also doesn't surprise me. I was totally, I was going to go Jews and then maybe Mormons because, you know, Mormons have that whole thing where it's like 7 days a week. It's like every single day they got a way to sort of be pounding that into your head. Whereas Catholics probably know the least, I would imagine, because Catholics, it's like, you know, as long as on your deathbed you go like, I regret everything, fun. And then all is forgiven. You don't really have to pay attention to it at any other point in your life. So I get this answer. Atheist, he says there are three groups, atheists, agnostics, Mormons, and Jews.
Overall results on the entire set of 32 questions that we asked, there are three groups that come out on top, atheists and agnostics, Mormons, and Jews.
It's just phrased strangely, is what I'm saying.
Well, they're lumping them together as essentially non-believers.
As other.
As other.
As an agnostic, I do not want to be lumped in with those damned atheists.
That's what I'm
right
saying.
Now.
All right. Here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our penis watch.
Here's your penis watch for Wednesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Take a look at my enormous penis
and my
my troubles start a melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
Here is Don Taylor with your penis watch for Wednesday, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
A jury on Friday acquitted a 22-year-old man from Florida who was accused...
I'm sorry, from where, Don?
Florida. Accused of exposing himself in front of a school bus filled with DeLand High School honor students, finding the act was a prank gone wrong. James Richmond did not expose his genitals, as police, prosecutors, and angry parents said he did, the jury found. Instead, it was a Halloween costume that featured a large fake penis that he was wearing, intending to get a laugh. Richmond, an engaged utility worker from Sanford, erupted in tears of joy when the verdict was announced. He faced 30 years in prison if convicted of lewd and lascivious exposure in front of two 14-year-old boys who saw what they thought was a real penis. Richmond, who was arrested in November 2008, also faced being labeled a sex offender for the rest of his life. 2 years of unconscionable hell for James and his family, said defense lawyer Aaron Delgado. With the thought of being labeled a sex offender hanging over his head, today for the first time in 2 years, this nightmare is over. Will said that between November 3rd and November 17th, Richmond repeatedly drove past the DeLand High School bus on its route into Barrie, Florida. He would expose himself to people on the bus, said prosecutor Ryan Will, and he would masturbate for his own gratification. An appellate court earlier this year ruled it was legal for a Hernando County man to put a sex toy resembling a penis into his mouth in front of a 7-year-old child. So that was your precedent.
You know, we just have the strangest conglomeration of laws in this country. There's got to be times when being a judge has got to be the most tedious profession on earth. But there's got to be times where you just wake up and you can't wait to get to the office, you know, because you're just going to sit there and you're going to hear about a guy who's like getting it on with some sort of an inflatable farm animal, you know. Well, and then with this, where they know that they were, in fact, honor students. So they had the purest minds of all that should not be sullied by seeing a male member in any way.
Yes, each of the two 14-year-old boys testified that on more than one occasion they had seen the man in the dark Volkswagen Jetta drive up and appear smiling and rubbing his genitals. But apparently he was wearing a Halloween costume.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by dildos.
Wow. Are you really doing a Ginsburg dildo joke right there?
I was, yes.
Awesome.
I don't need... There's so many things here. It's like, on the one hand, 30 years for exposing yourself seems a lot.
It seems a little excessive.
On the other hand, the fact that apparently he's been acquitted, he's completely innocent of doing anything wrong, even though he repeatedly buzzed a school bus several times and apparently masturbated a fake penis. That, of course, that's okay.
But I want to know, if it's a prank went wrong, what was the prank supposed to be?
I mean,
why did he do it over and over again?
That was actually going to be my next question, is what was his desired outcome here? What was the intended result that he was unable to, you'll forgive this, achieve or sustain by using the fake... the penis. I just don't. You know, and it's like the prank gone wrong. Here's the thing about the internet is it's like you just think about how many bad, terrible, awkward, strange, weird situations have resulted from something going poorly, and that something was supposed to be a zany video that you were going to try to get on Funny or Die or something. And it was like you and your drunk frat house buddies had a great idea for something that was going to be a hilarious laugh fest. And then the next thing you know, it's like somebody, you know, is on fire and somebody else is at the hospital and somebody else is filing sex assault charges.
I mean, it raises the question of how it could have gone right.
Yeah, I just don't know. These are the sorts of things that keep me awake at night, really, really and truly. All right, there you go. There's your penis watch for Wednesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Take a look at my enormous penis. My troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
All right, there's your penis watch for Wednesday. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. We're joined here by Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. We'll talk more about what is in the current issue here in just a moment. We have more news on the way, including a corpse watch and so forth. Today's Rick Emerson show brought to you by such folks as Mr. Michael Beatty, proprietor of The Cleaning Solution. Hey, just real quickly, though, have you seen, and there's two things that I've been forwarded a lot in the last couple of days, speaking of pranks gone wrong. One is... It's the latest in what appear to be a long series. About every 8 months, the internet will cough up a video of a guy attempting to create a flaming drink and then setting himself ablaze in front of all his friends. And it is always at a frat house where in the background there's just like a lot of drunk girls and just a lot of like in the other room. And a guy's going, hey, check this out. Which that's when you know you're in for something glorious. When the guy's just like, hey, watch this, or look over here, or like, hey, point that camera this direction for a second. And he's doing what Brian Cox would call the long pour in Cocktail, where he's doing the thing of like he starts pouring and then he lifts the bottle up and but it's hard to explain, but he starts to pour it and then it's like he sort of throws a match in and then continues the pour while lifting it, and then it just becomes like a long chain of fire racing up out of the glass back to the bottle and covering his hand in flames. And it's just so deeply satisfying to watch, like on every level. And then, of course, they do the obligatory slowing it. Look at this. And then it's the hand. The other thing I've received a lot this week, and I have no idea what this has to do with cleaning your house, because you can't really clean fire. That's a thing that doesn't really work.
Smoke damage, though, cleaning.
I like what you're saying, and we're going to use that right here. The other thing I've been forwarded a lot is this video. Have you noticed this? It's become harder and harder to tell with certain internet videos if something is truly candid and just kind of caught accidentally or if it's set up. Because people have gotten real savvy. They've seen enough internet videos now. It's hard to spot what's fake and what's not. Aaron, do you have a...
Well, those kids on the bus who saw the penis can back you up on
that.
Yeah,
sometimes you think it's real.
That's the thing.
And it's not.
And it's like you think it's one way, but it's really the other way. So this guy sent me this video, and he's the second person to do so. Where there's some dudes doing something in the kitchen, and, you know, they're whatever. They're screwing around. They're playing grab ass, as my grandfather would say. But then they hear, like, this weird thumping noise, and like, what the hell is that? And they're like, I don't know, let's check it out. And so you get the whole weird, jiggly Cloverfield thing as they're walking up the stairs, and they open this bedroom door upstairs, and there is someone, presumably an older brother or whatever, who lives in the house, and he's, like, humping it out with an inflatable doll. And it's so awkward and embarrassing, and you see the guy's junk, too, which makes me think that that's not a setup, that it is a thing that was just accidentally caught on film. Because even for a gag...
Did he have an actual, you know...
Was he tumescent?
Yes.
He immediately does the thing of trying to pull the covers over himself and just saying, like, get out! Like, really angrily. With a note of genuine discomfort in his voice, which makes me think it was real. So you just get a little flash. He did seem to be turgid degree.
That would be the selling point to me, would be...
It's not just for demonstration purposes.
Right.
Well, in any event, cleaning your carpet has nothing to do with whatever we were just saying, but it is because of the largesse of such business partners as The Cleaning Solution that you're able to hear/be horrified by these observations right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. You can find out more about them at 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. Mr. Michael Beatty, who is, in fact... Are you hanging your head in awkwardness?
I have these moments every once in a while when it suddenly occurs to me that, like, this is my job.
Yes. Absurdly enough.
This is actually, you know, I am a one-third owner in the Emerson News Network, and this is my livelihood and my job and the product of which I am proud. And we're talking about turgid members and carpet cleaning.
You got to give the people what they want, Don.
Humping it out with a inflatable doll.
Look, I am only a messenger for my culture. I am simply a mirror held up to American society and reflecting our own interests and perversions back. All right, you're misdirecting your awkwardness and uncomfortability. And by the way, and as you said, when you lose track of the site that is actually a business sometimes, and we say business partner, we're not just being colloquial or figurative there. Actually. Helping to provide you said humping story.
Exactly.
Mr. Michael Beatty, actually our first advertiser, our first business partner. He was the first one to come on board. And for that alone, he deserves your unwavering and unyielding support and devotion. 971-533 and his tolerance.
He is not left.
971-533-3211 for your carpet, upholstery, tile, marble, stone, walkway, flagstones, your hardwood flooring, anything in your house that your feet might touch, anything that gets stuffed up or dirty, because you don't want to just be look around and be horrified, by the state of your carpet. So, tell you what, have him into your home, have him into your office, residential or home cleaning. 971-533-3211. That is Mr. Michael Beatty. Once again at the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Actress Chloe Grace Moretz, seen earlier this year in Kick-Ass, plays a vampire in the thriller Let Me In, directed by Matt Reeves, which we have already talked about and have told you not to go see. The film centers on a boy who befriends a young girl, only to discover she's a vampire. Moretz discusses seeing herself on screen.
Even though I'm part of the very scary part in it, I'm probably going to be freaked out. Because most of the scary movies I do, you know, thrillers and, you know, darker movies, I'm still pretty freaked out by them.
I'm like,
oh my gosh, I don't remember shooting that.
Okay. I feel like a failed geek because I never saw Kick-Ass. I feel like I have to turn in my Ain't It Cool membership or whatever because I forget why. Maybe it was during the ramp up to when we were launching this whole thing. It was around that time. It seemed like I was just so busy and then I looked up and it was gone.
Kick-Ass was one of those movies, in a way, it is culturally, it was, I think, similar to Watchmen. It got, like, there was so much buzz and there was so much talk about it for so long before it hit theaters. And then it came out and everybody went to see it and went, yeah, okay, did that. And immediately, like, stopped thinking about it and
Scott
moved on
Pilgrim.
To other things. Yeah, Scott Pilgrim, same thing.
Where the buzz was so disproportionate to the actual...
Yeah. And Kick-Ass is not a terrible movie. It was a lot of fun. But at the same time, much like Scott Pilgrim, you go... Well, yeah, enjoyed that. What's next?
Right, and then it's just sort of done.
That's for lunch. Yeah.
And just real quickly, to go back to this point. So this is called Let Me In, right?
It is.
I don't understand why the other one is called Let the Right One In, and I don't understand why this one is called, like, neither title seems to have anything to do with the actual film.
Let the Right One In is a lyric from a Morrissey song the director of the Swedish version was obsessed with. So it's a personal thing, and I don't quite understand it, but it's cool. And then Let Me In is just shortened because Let the Right One In didn't make any sense to the American director.
So it really is. So if you have not seen Let the Right One In, you are poorer for it. You really do need to. Offhand, though, here's the thing. Somebody asked me in the text box just now. They said, if I want to rent, you know, the original, how can I make sure I'm getting the good version? And I don't really know the answer to that. Is there any way for them to tell what version? Because one of the subtitles, it's not like the movie won't make any sense if you see the bad version. It's just they take all the poetry out of the language. The subtitles, the language is just very flat and uninteresting.
I don't think, the problem is I don't think you can unless, there might be a difference in these, the text with American, like, region 1 DVDs versus different regions. I don't know. But, like, my thing is, I've got two discs at home, and they're both different. But the thing is, one is the DVD release, and the other one was an actual screener I got when the film was released. And that one has the theatrical subtitles on it. And so...
So if you go over to Don Taylor's home...
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, you can see it if you borrow it from me. You know, I don't know. Or you might try... I don't know. I don't want to suggest anyone download anything illegally.
No, of course not. That would be wrong.
Never.
But it doesn't seem... Well, there's probably a... I'll actually look online because we... You know, this can't be the first time this question has come up. So there's probably a webpage.
There must be an answer to this. I feel confident there is.
Some nerd has put up a page somewhere kind of telling you how to tell the two apart.
One of our person in the textbook says the good version, quote unquote, is the one on Netflix.
Oh, really?
So you can actually watch it Netflix on demand and see the one with the theatrical subtitles.
Fantastic.
You're welcome.
We're here with Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. What else is coming up in the current issue?
In the current issue, we also have an interview with Guillermo del Toro, who is appearing at the Baghdad tonight at 7 p.m. for $26.99.
And what is he promoting at Baghdad?
He's reading from a horror book he wrote. Apparently, this man doesn't sleep, so he has time to direct movies and write books and create monsters.
Did you interview him?
No, Andy Kreiser interviewed him.
Okay, I interviewed him when Blade 2 came out for InFocus magazine, and he was delightful. He was the nicest guy.
He seems like a real mensch.
And he's one of those guys, too, that when I started talking like Italian horror with him, and he just perked right up immediately. He was like, oh, you know, let's talk about Bava. And he was awesome. He was great. So, yeah, I think I actually forgot that was tonight and was hoping to go, and I don't know if I'll be able to make it.
You are doing – that's a good opportunity to mention that after this program is done, Don Taylor can be heard on PDX.fm at 4 p.m. this afternoon as part of Ham Fisted Radio with Bobby Roberts.
That's
What's
right.
coming up in today's exciting program, Don?
I'm not really sure. We had possibly had a guest, but that fell through. So it's just going to be Mr. Fatboy Roberts and I yapping at each other probably about movies and whining about our various lives, just like we usually do.
A delight.
A lot of self-conscious wanking about ourselves.
Excellent. Fantastic. That can be heard live this afternoon, 4 p.m. Pacific time on PDX.fm and downloaded later on if you miss it from hamfistedradio.com. www.thenewsdesk.com.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Here is Don Taylor at the News Desk.
Let's do the Corpse Watch.
Here's your Corpse Watch for Wednesday right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone.
Here is Don Taylor with your Corpse Watch for Wednesday.
A Wisconsin man accused of murdering his wife is facing a second felony for allegedly hiding her corpse in a closet. According to online court records, the information filed September 17th charges William R. Schmidt, 40, with one count of first-degree intentional homicide and one count of hiding a corpse. The hiding a corpse charge carries a potential 10-year prison sentence. Schmidt is accused of killing his wife, Lori J. Eckert Schmidt, 44, in mid-June, wrapping her body in a white comforter and hiding her in a bedroom closet in their Minocqua, Wisconsin residence for several days. Schmidt told his mother, Virginia Karstadt, that he killed his wife, quote, after she passed out, and added that she didn't suffer. He also told his mother the couple had been fighting and he was worried about the possibility of a divorce.
You know, this is the thing. Everybody's got an embarrassing relative or some guy, you know, in your family or somebody, and they do something that you don't really like to talk about publicly, or they're sort of the black sheep of the family. But it's like there's certain charges that there's just no minimizing it. There's no minimizing. Well, what is he guilty of? Well, you know, he sold drugs, you know, or what did he? Well, he stole some stuff. What do you? Well, misuse of a corpse. I mean, there's just no. There's no gilding that. Gilding is the wrong thing to say, but there's really no. There's no whitewashing that.
There's no gilding that corpse.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way to make that seem less horrible.
And then you go to prison, and you have to like explain it to the other guys in jail.
But see, I think that actually might be to your benefit in prison, because I think if you're the hiding, or as occasionally happens on this program, the buggering the corpse guy, I think you might get left alone. I think you might be, you know, because they're going to view you as the guy who, you know, just might, maybe not, but just might have filled his anus with broken glass before he came into the joint. So they're going to screw with you.
Well, police found the decomposing body while doing a health and welfare check on June 17th. According to the complaint, police believe Eckert Schmidt died sometime between June 12th and June 17th. The pathologist said she was unable to determine the exact cause of death due to the decomposition of the body. She said the body did not show signs of trauma and there was no indication that the death was caused by a disease. She did say that Schmidt suffered a fracture to the thyroid cartilage in her neck, but was unable to say if that injury had anything to do with causing her death. Schmidt lived with the dead body until June 16th, at which time he left the Minocqua area and traveled around the upper Midwest visiting friends and a casino. He turned himself into police June 24th at his mother's home in Sheboygan County and has been incarcerated ever since.
All right, there you go. There's your Corpse Watch for Wednesday.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone. Digging up bones.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Two messages from the text box. Guy says, first, did you get my voicemail? I have to go back and check those. The short answer is no. He said, did you get my voicemail about the psychiatric museum? This is the Glore Psychiatric Museum in Missouri. He said, I've been there. He left two messages about having toured that place. So we will get those. We'll play those back tomorrow. Another one says, you haven't commented on last night's Sons of Anarchy. Here's the thing about Sons of Anarchy. It's difficult to discuss that show on Wednesdays because you were still working your way through season one, right?
Yeah.
Aaron Mesh, Sons of Anarchy, yes?
Never seen it.
No, because you and I talked about this, right? You watched, was it you and I that discussed this, or was it, no, it was Michael Schaub. We talked about this. Did you, were you a S.H.I.E.L.D. fan?
I wasn't, no.
Okay, that's fine. You know, you're not dead to me like forever, but for the next 90 seconds or so, you're in like a,
but
you know.
Rick, honestly, I'm going to tell you, I'm not a TV guy.
You are, in fact, the screen editor.
Yeah, I watch like 15 movies a week.
Okay, fair enough. So this takes up all of the time you have that you would otherwise be polluting your brain with whatever's on television.
Serial television, and I don't get along real well.
Okay, no, fair enough. There's only so many hours in the day. Well, this is like my constant, you know, complaint that there's just not, that I need to, I have a second self who only watches television because I get so far behind with movies and TV that I need to clone myself, and then the other self would just sit at home in front of it and just have it running into his head like all the time. So I'm reluctant to really discuss Sons of Anarchy a lot because you're a couple seasons back right now.
And that's the thing is that by the time I get to it, though, I may have forgotten. So I suppose you could just talk about it.
I'll just say that there's a 3 or 4 episode arc, and I don't know if he's going to return or not, but there's a 3 or 4 episode arc with Hal Holbrook, which is the sort of thing that can be really distracting when there's a very prominent actor, somebody of note who's guest starring on a show. First of all, I tend to dislike that sort of thing anyway, because if there's somebody who is, you know, if there's somebody who's exceptionally famous or somebody who is a very well-established actor, then it's like you know instantly that they're not going to be on the show for the long haul. You know that it's just a couple episodes, you know, and then it almost feels like stunt casting. But I got to tell you, I was reading my email this morning from people who were watching the show last night, and Hal Holbrook is just like stunning. I mean,
So what kind of character is he playing?
He plays Katie Sagal's dad.
Oh.
Who you've never seen before. Yeah. That's the thing is she references her parents, but he plays Katie Sagal's dad. And Katie Sagal is just such a badass in that program. But they don't ever paint. The great thing about Sons of Anarchy is as much as it must be tempting or it would be easy as a writer just to depict all those guys and just with one note personalities, they don't ever do it. Everybody's sort of nuanced and layered. Here's the other great thing about Sons of Anarchy, not unlike The Shield and, you know, The Wire and some of those other shows, where they don't give the whole thing away in the first episode. Because what often happens in series television, as Aaron said, is that the first episode will have the guy who's the real hard case and he's a hard-drinking, you know, loner who plays by his own rules and, you know, and whatever. It's like the sort of David Caruso-style character.
They based that guy on me.
Well, I didn't want to come out and just say it. I suspected it was the case. But then at the end of the pilot episode, something will happen, usually involving a dead child or something. And it's like, and you'll see him cry and you'll understand that, you know, his heart isn't made of stone. But they give you like every single facet of the character at once. And some of the better television programs recently have learned that it's not necessary to do that. That you can actually take 3 or 4 years, like with Vic Mackey being the best example, to sort of develop a character. Speaking of Vic Mackey, by the way, I got somebody watched that. Is it last night that it premiered?
Yeah, I actually watched that.
The No Ordinary Family?
Yeah.
Was it just as bad as it seemed?
It wasn't as bad as it seemed like it could have been.
It could have been worse.
It wasn't great, but it's really weird though to watch a live action show that's so obviously based on The Incredibles, and then starring Vic Mackey, starring Michael Chiklis, you know, as the dad, and you know, and what's her name, and Darla, and what's her name from Dexter, Julie Benz,
yeah,
and it's got good. It's got good actors, and it's competently directed. It just wasn't, I don't know, particularly interesting.
It didn't seem like it needed to exist. It seemed like a premise. And as you said,
Heroes and The Incredibles have already come and gone, and people have already done that. And this is sort of a meshing of the two, and it doesn't seem, excuse me, but it doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem necessary. But then, almost all new television this season is just dreck. It's just ill-conceived.
This email says, I'm not going to watch even one episode of that new Michael Chiklis sitcom on ABC. Is it a sitcom or is it a dramedy?
Yeah, it's a dramedy. It's humorous, but it's also, I guess, there's some seriousness to it.
He just says, it's obviously going to be horrible, and I'm not curious enough to risk ruining my appreciation for him or for the character of Vic Mackey. How do you take a guy on top like Michael Chiklis coming off The Shield and stick him in this doomed sitcom about stereotypical superhero crap? What the hell? And it's like there's just no answer. And it's weird when you see guys who are coming off a series that has, this happens with a lot of shows, where they will finish something that is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And this, more than anything, I think, it talks about the fickle nature of show business, you know?
Well, in all fairness, like when you say Michael Chiklis is a guy on top, he may be artistically on top. But how much money did he make from The Shield? And the answer would probably be very little. This is a guy who, like, his last major film performance was as The Thing in Fantastic Four. He hasn't had a very financially lucrative career.
And that's a good—and he wasn't making—and even if he was the highest-paid guy on FX, he wasn't making network money, which is different.
Not even close.
Highest-paid
guy on FX is, like, you know, highest-paid player in the CFL.
Well done.
I will say, watching the scenes where he's doing his sort of heroes-like thing, where he's discovering his new powers and discovering that he can catch a fastball, like, shot out of, you know, a pitching machine, and then gets his buddy, because he himself is a sketch artist for the police department, so he gets his cop buddy to come and tells him to shoot him. And that scene was kind of amusing. But watching the thing where finally, you know, he's realizing he can catch bullets, and he is actually physically, you know, nigh invulnerable. And all I could think is, like, oh, my God, can you imagine if Vic Mackey had been invulnerable? Dear Lord, where would that have taken the shield if Vic Mackey just could not be killed?
Okay, seriously, right now I'm demanding that somebody do like a crossover comic or something where there is in fact like an invincible robotic Vic Mackey who just strides across Los Angeles like Colossus, just doing battle with gangs everywhere.
That'd be Robo-Vic.
Seriously, that'd be the best thing that had ever existed at all, ever. And I'm including the polio vaccine in that. It doesn't matter. I mean, it'd be better than anything.
Better than Frank and Hitler?
Yes. Well, maybe. Yes. Maybe. Yes. 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 How's Julie Benz? Because here's my suspicion about her. I have this hunch that she can't really act. And that the only good thing she was ever good in was Buffy. And that was just like the sort of fluke that proves that she has no real talent.
She's basically, doing the same thing that she did in Buffy and in Dexter, only being like less loadish and annoying than she was in Dexter. But then again, you know, so far she's the wife. You know, she also has like a job. She's like a working mom. And she discovers her power is she can run really fast.
Yeah.
And then she's Julie Benz.
Because the superheroes' powers are that he's invincible and she's fast, and like one of their kids is smart, and like their daughter's like a telepath or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think we've just reached the point where certain kinds of superhero stories have just, you know, there's just no other way to do it. It's like origin stories. It's like, we've just run out of ways to do an origin story and make it interesting.
This is also a TV series that is coming a good, like, three years past, like, the height of the superhero craze.
Right, right.
So it's like, it's over. That ship has sailed. Now everybody's on fairy tales. The next big wave is going to be, like, fairy tale movies. There's two Snow White movies and two Red Riding Hood movies in the works. Disney is doing reimagined because they made a gazillion dollars on Alice in Wonderland. So they're doing a Cinderella, a Maleficent starring Angelina Jolie. And they're doing a Cinderella movie.
Darren Aronofsky is doing the Snow White film.
That sounds right.
Is that Sleeping Beauty? I can never tell them apart. Which is the one where she eats the apple?
Snow White.
Snow White. So why is Sleeping Beauty doesn't eat the apple? She's not asleep because of the apple.
No, she pricked her finger on a needle.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. A spinning wheel.
Okay.
Needle. Thing.
Right.
Yeah.
This is two just morphed together, maybe. But I think Aronofsky's doing one of those, and they use the obligatory "it's going to be edgy" sort of description for that. So all right.
Yeah. So, but our next new wave of things is going to be fairy tale stuff, which means that within like 2 years after we get flooded with those, there's going to be fairy tale related TV shows, because that seems to be the way these go.
I don't know if I can describe on radio the degree to which my soul has just shriveled in the last 30 seconds hearing about this.
Just by hearing about the pipeline filled with fairy tale things.
With fairy tale dreck.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's...
And board game movies.
Hooray!
Including one... I did read, by the way, that Peter Berg is no longer attached to direct the Battleship.
See, that's too bad. I like Peter Berg so much.
The latest thing I heard is it was Ridley Scott.
So
I swear to God, it was like the good news, bad news. They said Peter Berg won't be directing Battleship. Ridley Scott has been attached to direct that project. Well, let's roll our top five, and then we will let Don skedaddle on out of here to do Ham-Fisted Radio over at PDX.fm. Aaron Mesh, the new issue is on stands now, yes?
It is.
Willamette Week. Pick it up, read Aaron Mesh's review of The Social Network, which opens this Friday.
It does.
And which does look, it just does look fantastic. And having read the book, and then I read the script, actually. But, you know, you never know, especially with Sorkin, who tends to overwrite everything.
But they packed everything in. The dialogue is done so fast. They put it's probably about a 2 hour and 45 minute movie into 2 hours even.
I was actually going to ask if it seemed, to whatever degree you were familiar with Sorkin's writing, if it had his sort of, you know, that imprimatur, if it had that sort of the very trademark, you know, where it's just bam, 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 and
the staccato rhythm's there, no question.
Yeah, and the editing, it's like done so closely together that it really is like, you know, that it's like this hyper-kinetic sort of feeling throughout the entire thing. All right, so here is your top five for Wednesday.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happy.
happiness. Counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Here is your You Look Positively Agog and or Aglow.
Well, I am, as I have established before, 73 years old. So I have to tell you that one of the songs on here was one of my childhood crushes.
And I
know every word to the song.
I think I know exactly who we're talking about. All right. These are the top five songs from October 4th, 1969. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
All right. October 4th, 1969. These are the top five songs from that day in history right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. What's honorable mention at number six, Don?
Honorable mention is the Rolling Stones' Honky Tonk Woman.
And I have to tell you that this is hands down one of my favorite songs of all time. Any genre, period,
yeah.
Ever.
I was also pleased because this is actually a good list. We've had some painful ones to
every now and again, the hand of Kronos is kind.
This song's real good.
There's this story that I've told before, but when I was about 12, my mom went off to like some sort of a meeting, or she was going out with some friends or something at night, and there wasn't like any real rock and roll in my house when I was growing up. It was all just kind of country and gospel. And my mom was gone, my brother was asleep, my dad was like passed out or whatever, and I was going through this big box of 45 records, and I found this like blue and white record that said Rolling Stones on it, and I'd sort of heard of them, but I didn't know what they did or what they sounded like, and it was this song. And my sister had apparently forgotten to take that one with her when she moved out, and so this is like 8 o'clock, and I just put the record on, and I, you know, drop the needle down, and you know, and it was that starts with that cowbell right there that he's and it's got that Charlie Watts kind of like groove to it that only he can really do. And it sounds like there's about four different guitars playing at the same time. And my mom came home like 2.5 hours later, and I was still sitting in front of the stereo playing it over and over and over. And she screamed at me because apparently, as she tells it, I had it so loud that the windows of the house were rattling. And all I know is that it didn't seem like 2.5 hours, but I just played it relentlessly until she, like, physically removed me from the front room of the house. And it just sounded... I didn't even know what he was talking about. With something. Like, I didn't know when, you know, she blew my nose and then she blew my mind.
A lyric that confused the heck out of me as a Christian child in Florida.
Me too. And I had no idea what that meant. But the thing is, I knew it was sort of... dirty. I knew it meant something, you know, sinful and awesome. And, you know, the I laid a divorcee in New York City, and I kind of knew what that meant. And it's just such a great song. I mean, it's just such a great, vile, dirty, horrific, beautiful song. It really is just wonderful. I can just picture you were about the same age, just peering at the stereo and just squinting and going, blew my nose.
The things that grown-ups do.
Yeah. Sex doesn't sound fun at all.
He had a cold. She was taking care of him. And then she said something that he found surprising.
Well, golly day.
That's what I always thought it meant. And,
but no, I was sharp enough to know it meant something other than that. I just didn't know what it was. It was mysterious.
I wasn't sharp enough to know that for a long time. Of course, I think I've told you about how, like, my husband just a couple of years ago looked at me and said, "Really? You have no idea what ZZ Top's Pearl Necklace is about?" And I was like, "No, I'd never heard that phrase before." He's like, "Seriously?"
I wish I'd been in the car when he was explaining the two. You know, I don't mean that in a creepy way. Just the idea that, I mean, you're a woman of the world. The idea that you didn't know. Did you think it was just about jewelry?
I never really thought about it. I never really listened to ZZ Top, and I didn't really know. It's like, oh, they have some song called Pearl Necklace. And I guess I assumed, okay, it's about some dame wearing a pearl necklace. And then Patrick made some reference to it, and I was like, "What?" And so, yeah, like the ZZ Tops, the thing. I was like, that's a phrase? Ew!
The top five songs from October 4th, 1969. Don Taylor, what's number five?
Number five is The Temptations' I Can't Get Next to You.
One of the great intros of all time.
I can turn to green.
You know, it's so hard to hear some of these songs and to separate them from the years and years and years of overplaying and of being used to death in every commercial and every movie and seeing Joe Beth Williams, like, dance around a kitchen with, you know, with Mary Kay Place or whatever. But when you actually just sit and listen to it and you realize that this is basically a song factory where they just cranked out pure unadulterated genius, like, on a daily basis. I mean, it's just astounding.
If all those little fairy tale movies have this song in it, I will like them.
And Born to be Wild. And Bad to the Bone.
I mean, just listen to that piano.
Well, it's that and that, and there's that, I used to know his name, but the guy who was the house drummer for most of the Motown singles. And it's just, I mean, come on. How awesome is that?
That documentary on
Standing in the Shadows of Motown.
Yeah.
Where they have it, and I forget the name of the band, but it was the house band at Motown that
yep.
did the instrumental backing. And you know, and that they together they'd played on more number one singles than like the Beatles and Elvis and Elton John combined
yep.
or something. And sometimes, you know,
and yet they all died poverty stricken.
Well, then one guy was like playing piano at a Nordstrom or something, you know, for spare change. But it's like that drumming where it's like he lays back and it's just barely... I mean, it just does the job it needs to do, but in this perfect fashion. It's like the guy who drummed on Otis Redding songs is the same way. And then I unfortunately now associate this song with Elizabethtown, which is just regrettable. All right, these are the top five songs from October 4th, 1969.
Number four is Three Dog Night, Easy to Be Hard.
This was your crush, wasn't it? It was Danny Hutton.
Oh, no. No, we haven't gotten to my crush yet. My crush is number three.
So odd that Three Dog Night were ever rock stars. This country does strange things sometimes. It's like every now and again you go to the ocean and something really bizarre has washed up on shore. It's been disgorged by the sea.
Mm-hmm.
We're like that with musicians. Every now and again we just kind of go, bleh, Phil Collins. And then he, you know, he's a rock star for the next 5 years. This makes no sense.
What was it? Been a little baffled by this song too, because it's a song about, like, don't be mean to people, which seems like an odd sort of a pop song theme.
It was the summer of 2 years after the Summer of Love. It was the 60s. They were, you know, they're hippies. What are you gonna do? Well, I don't remember the song being this slow and pointless.
It is difficult to believe that this song was more popular than I Can't Get Next to You.
It really is, actually. It,
I like that little Hammond organ
in the
background,
though. Who care about evil and social injustice?
Wow.
It's hard to forget that line. It's that bad.
I here's the thing. I don't mean this ironically. I'm impressed, actually. I'm always impressed by people who know songs that, A, they really shouldn't, you know, just based on, you know, sort of your read on them personally, and then also that there's no point to knowing. You know, Dawn has sat here and just known every word and has done the most useless, you know.
It's seaweed of the brain.
Like the next one,
yeah.
For example.
I mean, they're just barnacles. They just crop up inside your head. God damn. Well, you actually were not here for this top five a few weeks ago. Last time I was in the studio. And it was like, it was the 70s top five where it was just nothing but like Anne Murray and Climax.
God.
And he knew like every single word to every song. It was sort of awe-inspiring. Kind of glorious in an awful way. All right, these are the...
It's not easy to live inside it, though, let me tell you.
These are the top five songs from October 4th, 1969. Don Taylor.
Bobby Sherman, Little Woman.
You're gyrating with enthusiasm. Please now to explain your love for Bobby Sherman.
Hey, little woman, please make up your mind. You've got to.
Or just point at me and sing.
World and leave your world behind.
Come on now. Na, 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 na. You've got to.
Come down from that cloud, girl, and leave your world behind.
I love the show.
So, I.
Now, is this in your day, Dawn, in aught five? Did they have? Now, they didn't have like Tiger Beat or anything then,
yeah,
but they had magazines of that ilk, right?
And Bobby Sherman was one of the huge Tiger Beat and 16 magazine stars, starting because he was one of the stars of Here Come the Brides, which was based on Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. I can't remember the name of Jeremy Bolt. I think was the oldest brother, but the two younger brothers were David Soul and Bobby Sherman.
Were you a David Soul fan as well?
Not really, no, because I was a Paul Michael Glaser fan during the Starsky and Hutch years, but because I always liked the dark-haired guys with the big noses. But and Bobby Sherman, gorgeous guy, big nose, and quite the dreamy pop star.
I got to get Richard Belzer here for you, stat. This is a pretty great pop song. It really is. You've got the dreamiest look on your face. It's like you are on your own private planet of bliss.
I loved him so much.
Now I feel compelled to get an interview with Bobby Sherman.
My dad actually met him, and I was so angry that he met him, and I didn't know about it, but he didn't know he was going to meet him either. My dad was a fireman, captain of the fire department, and he worked as a consultant on the TV show Emergency for a week. And it turns out Bobby Sherman, post-pop star career, actually was a volunteer fireman. He became a fireman, and he was working with the LA Fire Department. My dad came home and was like, "Oh, I was working on this TV show, and guess who I met? Bobby Sherman." I was like, "I hate you! I hate you so much!" Even though this was like a good, 10 or 15 years after I had been in love with him, it was still like, bastard.
Yeah, but I mean, of all the things that Bobby Sherman could have become, the fact that he became a fireman makes him like triply hot.
Oh yeah, he was delightful. I loved him so much.
You know, there's really no guy equivalent to the boy band thing for girls. You know, because girls, you know, every generation of girls has a boy band, and then there's always the, you know, well, are you a Jonathan Knight or a Jordan Knight? You know, girl
and,
or whatever.
Yeah, and every woman has one.
Oh yeah, Sarah. Were you here when I the New Kids on the Block?
Yeah, they're
trading cards. So, in fact, Joe Squires of Squires Electric, one of our fine business partners, he passed these New Kids on the Block cards along, and Sarah was just like, she was so giddy about them because she's such a big fan of New Kids on the Block. But there is guys don't have an equivalent. I mean, and I don't even mean there's no band for guys where you pick your favorite, you know, girl or whatever. I can't even think of. I can't even think of anything that is even a quasi equivalent to that. You know, guys have sports teams, I guess, is maybe the closest thing to it. So,
and porn stars.
There's porn stars. No, sure.
There
no,
yeah,
there you stars. Go. No, fair enough. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. You and Zussman should bond about that at some point. Just talk about who your favorite porn stars are.
That's what we do on Thursdays.
Although, and awesome. I know guys that get that dreamy look if you mention Linda Carter from Wonder Woman or Aaron Gray from Battlestar Galactica. Yeah, the guys will get that oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, Aaron Linda Gray. Carter. No, yeah. I'm with you on that. Yeah. Okay, no, fair enough.
So that's similar.
All right, this is your top five from October 4th, 1969. By the way, I should take a brief interlude here to say that the top five, like everything else on the program, is brought to you by a fine variety of business partners, including the Castalia Learning Center. Castalia Learning Center, which is a Spanish language school in beautiful downtown Portland, Oregon. Aaron Mesh, do you speak Spanish?
No.
Okay. See, it's made for you. This is designed for you.
I was trying to figure out how to say no in Spanish, and then I remembered that it was no.
No.
So it all worked out.
Yeah, that was great.
That was either the worst joke ever or the most cerebral. You almost should have just, if you ever do that joke again, you should almost just let it lie and just go, no, and then arch an eyebrow, maybe, if you ever tell that joke on television.
Just let a beat go and then say, senor.
And then just give it a little aside to the camera, sort of knowingly, Norman Fell style. Jesus, I don't even know what we're doing. Well, in any event... they are a Spanish language school in downtown Portland. They have classes for adults. They limit the class size to 8 people, and whatever your level of Spanish knowledge, whether you're just starting out, whether you have intermediate knowledge, whether you are an advanced Spanish speaker, I love that little trill that happens in the background right there, and you just want to brush up on your skills, they can help you with that, and any time that works for you, they'll make it work for them. So whatever days of the week are best for you, whatever time of day, they'll find something that works with your schedule. Claire Grebel is the owner of Castalia Language Center. She's a native Spanish speaker from Argentina, and she operates Castalia Language Language Center in downtown Portland, Oregon. You find out more about them at PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com. That's how you contact Castalia Language Center. We now return to your top five. Don Taylor, what is number two?
It is someone named Oliver with their song Gene.
This is just an individual performer.
Oh, is it from the
I don't believe it's
movie?
From
oh, no, it's
no, this is just
it, the band is it's a band called
It's a
Oliver?
Guy. And
a
I don't guy. I don't think it's like cousin Oliver, like a known Oliver. I actually had to I have to confess, I was hoping you would illuminate me a little bit on this point because most of the time in the top five I have at least some cultural knowledge of the performer. And between the two of us, you and I cover most genres of music and most eras, but I got nothing. Aaron Mesh, Willamette Week?
I actually know where this song comes from.
Please to explain.
Weirdly enough, unless I am completely wrong, because I was really into, soft AM radio when I was, 10, and I looked up where this song came from because I thought it was, the most romantic thing I'd ever heard when I was, 11. And I believe that it actually was the theme song to the prime of Miss Jean Brody.
It is. You're right, because I did. And it was written by Rod McKeown.
And the prime of Miss Jean Brody is based on the novel by, I don't remember, she just died. Someone should look this up.
Someone should.
Yeah. Sorry. The prime of Miss Jean Brody is a novel by a novelist who just passed this year.
Muriel Spark.
And it's about a school teacher who's kind of a fascist. And the movie is sort of dark and disturbing, and this song does not belong in it at all.
Okay, I continue to be impressed with you. You have to spend more time here.
I'll try.
Here's the thing: you're one of us, Aaron Mesh. As horrifying as that may be, it is true. Apparently, now I just looked this up here. So his full name is William Oliver Swafford.
With a name like that, why would you shorten it?
He's just. Why wouldn't you just go to the club with Mitzi? let's see. He was known just professionally as Oliver. He's from North Carolina, and he died about 10 years ago. He teamed up with Karen Carpenter in the late 70s. So
that makes sense.
He does sound exactly like a guy who would ally himself with the Carpenters, doesn't he?
Interesting. The Swafford was the last name of the kid in Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. And Marilyn Monroe is looking forward to being seated with this millionaire at their table on the cruise. And it turns out he's like a little kid with these big glasses. And she keeps referring to him as Mr. Swafford. And for some reason, that stuck in my head.
We're just a collection of Wikipedia footnotes at this point. Not even full entries. Just what we are? We're like those little reference points at the bottom that end up on the discussion page where somebody says, non-germane to the article, deleted.
But I'm trying to think of a current equivalent for this. Remember that movie The Reader with Kate Winslet where the Nazi sleeps with a little boy? Imagine if there'd been a love theme to that.
Touching theme, so to speak,
from The Reader.
Although we get a lot of that, though, in movies, though. It's only they're always over the end credits now.
True.
Where there'll be some just vastly inappropriate song that has nothing to do with the movie.
Oh, my favorite recently is that that owl cartoon, Legend of the Guardians, The Owls of Gahool, that terrible, terrible owl cartoon, has a theme song that plays over the closing credits by the band Owl City.
And it's about owls.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And believing in yourself.
Yes. So it's like, it's the owl movie, got the band Owl City to do a song about owls.
I love how the version you have of this, by the way, has people clapping every time that he starts to sing again.
Well, because it's... Look, man, it's William Oliver Swafford. I mean, these are the top five songs from October 4th, 1916. And this has been the weirdest top five. I mean, we're just all over the place here. What is number one, Don Taylor?
Well, number one is The Archies' Sugar Sugar.
I love this song.
I do, too.
I'm the biggest fan of this song.
Yay.
I have this two-disc Archies retrospective at home. I could listen to this all day. You are my candy girl. I mean, I would say that they don't write them like this anymore, but they really do. I mean, that's the other thing we get every year is we get it. This is why I never, I can criticize with the best of them. I can hate with anybody. But it gets a lot for me to criticize a pop song or a well-done pop record, and genres and styles. The particular arrangement style or production style of decades, it just varies. And, every year it changes up a little bit. But a great pop song is a hard thing to do. And this is one of the best examples you'll ever find.
And you're a sucker for clapping.
I really am. Clapping in a song?
Yep.
Yeah, if you got just a little... in the background, I am yours. I'm in your pocket.
And this is actually not that hard a song to do. The difficulty level is not too bad for karaoke.
I can see that.
Yeah.
There's this great book from, actually, it's a local book. It's from Fierro House called Bubblegum Music is the Naked Truth. And I always want to say Kim Fowley, but that's the guy who managed the Runaways. It's a name like that, but it's the editor. And it's just a whole examination of the history of bubblegum music up until, I think, 2003. And there's a whole section about the Archies. And they interview Ron Dante, the guy who was the singer for most of the... He did most of the voices, including the women. He was the arranger. They talk to the composers. And they interview the studio musicians in, like, the Ohio Express and the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. And it is just...
Wait. Sorry, I had to hear that part.
But to hear the musicians okay. interviewed is really great because the musicians themselves, it's like the Motown guys, where nobody knows the musicians who played on the Archies records or on the Sugar Bears records that you got on the back of a cereal box. And to see these guys actually get a chance to talk about it is fantastic. Don't you think it's about time that some, you know, like teenage trollop, re-record this and release it, you know, on like on Puffy Combs' label, you know, something?
Don't even put that idea out into the
I'm
atmosphere.
I'm just saying.
Because it's going to happen now.
You know, like one of Mandy Moore's younger sisters or something. All right, excellent. There's your top five from October 4th, 1969. Excellent. Way to go. Don't forget to listen to Dawn Taylor this afternoon, 4 p.m. Pacific time at pdx.fm for Hamfisted Radio, or listen to it at hamfistedradio.com. Aaron Mesh, the new issue is on stands now. Willamette Week, read it in print or online at wweek.com. After a brief musical interlude here, the Rick Emerson Show will continue, preceded by an encore of today's Legion of News installment. So that happens next. You can also check out Fun Employment Radio at funemploymentradio.com. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Miss Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. Today's guest, Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. Again, read him in print in Willamette Week or online at wweek.com. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network here, high above the milk packing district in beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor. Advanced technology magic provided by Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Wednesday, September 29th, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.
The proceeding was a production of the Emerson News Network.
Let's get it all in perspective. For all y'all enjoyment, a song y'all can step with. Y'all appointed me to bring rap justice, but I ain't 5-0, y'all know it's Nas, yo. Grey Goose and a whole lot of hydro. Only describe us as soldier survivors. Stay laced in the best, well-dressed with finesse in the white tee, looking for white meat. The girl who fly and talk so nicely. Put her in the coupe so she can feel the nice breeze. We could drive through the city, no doubt, but don't say my car's topless. Say the out. Newness, here's the anthem. Put your hand up that you shoot with, count your loot with. Push the pool stick in your new crib, same hand that you hoop with. Swing around like you stupid. King of the town, yeah, I've been that. You know I click clack, where you and your men's at? Through the smurf, through the wop, baseball bat. Rooftop like we bringing 88 back. They shooting. Oh, I made you look. You a slave to a page in my rhyme book. Getting big money, playboy, your time's up. With them gangsters, with them dimes at. They shooting. Oh, I made you look. You a slave to a page in my rhyme book. Getting big money, playboy, your time's up. Where them gangsters at? Where them dimes at? This ain't rapping, this is street hop. Now get up off your ass like your seat's hot. My lob lit up the reefer. Trunk of the car, we got the street sweeper. Don't start none, won't be none. No reason for your mans to panic. You don't wanna see no ambulances. Knock a pimp's drink down in his pimp cup. That's the way you get Timberland up. Let the music diffuse all attention. Baller convention, free admission. Hustlers, dealers, and killers can move swift. Girls get close, you can feel where the tools kept. All my just coming homies, parolees. Get money, leave the beef alone slowly. Get out my face, you people so phony.
Pull out my waist, the Eagle 440. They shooting. Oh, I made you look. You a slave to a page in my rhyme book. Getting big money, playboy, your time's up. With them gangsters, with them dimes at. They shooting. Oh, I made you look. You a slave to a page in my rhyme book. Getting big money, playboy, your time's up. Where them gangsters at? Where them dimes at? I see running. Yo, my mood is real rude. I lay you out, show you what still do. Mobsters don't box, my pump shot obliges. Every invitation to fight your punk asses. Like Punch said, you ain't even in me class. Made batch, bins, backseat, TV plasma. Ladies looking for athletes or rappers. Whatever you choose, whatever you do. Make sure he a thug and intelligent too. Like a real thoroughbred is. Show me love, let me feel how the head is. Females, who's the sexiest? Is always the nastiest. And I like a little sassy. A lot of class, mommy reaching your bag. Past the fifth, I'm a leader at last. This a Don you with, my nines a spit. Lose consciousness,